This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Ryan Lee Dosti about her book called Formation. The subtitle is really important. It's called A Woman's Memoir of Stepping Out of Line. And it is I really found this book very painful in a lot of ways. I am sure painful for you because it is about your being raped.
Yes.
In the Army. And you start off right away telling that story. Without repeating everything that's the story that's in the book, we'll talk about, maybe we can talk about, you know, kind of around what happened, you
sure.
know, and you can talk about maybe, I'm kind of interested in the structure of this book and how you built it, because you start off with this really powerful event, and then it's not a completely going back to the past, because you go back and forth to different times. So maybe you could talk a little bit about. You don't have to say what prompted you to write this book because that's what it's about, but more like how did you figure out how to structure
this? The structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know the structure is a little unconventional in that it's not chronological. This is probably the worst answer ever, but I wrote that chapter, which is the first chapter of the book. That was not the first chapter I wrote. But once I wrote it, had the first sentence and the first like leading into it, both me and I was in an MFA program at the time, my professor, we just thought it was powerful. And it just seemed like a really good place to start. And I've had people tell me now, they've been concerned or surprised that it opens with such a sexually violent moment. And I didn't consider that would affect the readers in a way. Like I didn't write saying, this is what I think the readers are going to feel. I just sort of wrote it. And then later.
Well, I think that's better. I think you don't want to kind of overthink, you know, the other, like, I mean, you do want the editor's job. Is
yeah. The and I have a fantastic editor.
I don't think I found it off-putting. Mm-hmm. I think that but it is very painful. You know, you engage the reader right away in a lot of complicated emotions.
Yeah.
You know, yours and also for the reader who is vicariously experiencing this. And how old were you when this happened?
I was newly 21, so I just had started partying Army style.
Right.
Which is very hard.
So
and very often.
How old were you when you joined the Army?
I was 19. Because I actually graduated high school at 19. I was a little bit older than my peers due to a child illness kind of thing. I enlisted during my senior year, and then you get to do like this delayed program. You finish high school, and then you ship out.
Right.
And
this was in 2000.
2000, September of 2000.
So because a lot of people talk about joining after 9/11.
Yeah, completely different.
Right, this was a different experience.
Yeah.
And what I meant to look this up, what year was it that women first entered the armed forces?
Oh, God. Was the women's forces?
Let's say women approved to be inactive. In active combat.
Oh, that was probably like, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
In combat arms, you mean. Women have been in active combat for decades now.
Right.
But just being approved to be in combat arms, I want to say is in the past 2 to 3 years.
So I'm just sort of trying to figure out like the kind of context of what the military was like at that time, you know, which is almost 20 years ago.
Oh, God.
I know, it's hard. But because presumably... I mean, this is a lot of what the book is about is this male culture.
Yeah.
The Army having traditionally been, I mean, every one of us who has not been in the Army or armed forces has seen television or movies about
and they're all
basic
male.
Training.
Yeah.
You know, you go to all these movies about World War II, the Vietnam War, Korea, it's all men. And of course, the training programs are brutal.
Yeah.
They're meant to shape the soldier into a fighting machine.
Yes.
Basically, take away a lot of the personal and personality and instill more
civility.
Yeah.
It's meant to break you from being a civilian, from being civil,
exactly.
into something more honed, more capable of a violence that naturally humans don't want to commit, usually.
Right.
Yeah.
See, that's all very, it's all, what our image of it is all very male, but what you experienced directly in the Army was that male, patriarchal, as we call it, militaristic culture, although you also later discover that kind of militarism and sexuality are linked and that there's a place for female power there.
Yes. Oh, I definitely think do. I think it takes a certain personality type to join the military, whether it be pre 9/11, post 9/11, or different branches. And I don't think that personality type is exclusive to men. And I think we as a society assume that. We assume that men are more likely to run into danger or to take on these incredibly hard tasks. And I think maybe not in the same percentages, but there's definitely women who have that same personality. They want that adventure, they want that challenge, or the honor, or feel like they're doing something for their country.
Well, and you even talk about it for yourself and for some of the other women, this sense of empowerment that comes from being able to accomplish things that you couldn't have accomplished before.
Yes, there's a real, and I explained this in the basic training part, there's a real powerful feeling being in the military, at least in my experience, being, you're a part of this bigger machine, and you feel like you're a part of doing something so much bigger than yourself. That's kind of hard to replicate in the civilian world. For many, it can be pretty addicting, and it's very hard once you get out of that to suddenly be such a singular individual in a civilian world with so many other people that are singular individuals.
Well, and also there's the fraughtness of being in the war zone, and you talk about that even within the Army or within the military. When you have a combat patch, you stand out.
Yes.
But also there's that feeling of being, I remember from friends who went to Vietnam, being in country. Mm-hmm. That in country was being in a different world.
Yes.
But a different mind. In your mind as well, you're a different being. And then when you come back, you have to turn that off.
And that's the hard part. It's very hard to turn it off.
It's very difficult. And I think
to adjust with it halfway on. Because I don't know if you ever do turn it off. No,
it doesn't go away. But I think everybody deals with it differently.
Yes.
I think that I've known a lot of veterans, people who've been in the military at different stages. I've known, I'm old enough to have known people who actually fought in World War One. I used to see Spanish American War veterans at Memorial Day parades when I was a little kid. Yeah, so that's
insane.
It is. Cool.
That's very interesting.
Well, it wasn't that long ago, really. And so you have now, many years of people in America coming home from a war.
Yeah.
And I think the experience, and you saw that, I think, when you talked about that a little bit, when you came home, the other veterans from other wars immediately recognizing how you were, what you were going through, even though you didn't know it.
Yeah, they knew probably before I did. And I also didn't feel deserving in the sense that, if you compare what veterans went through in World War II or Vietnam or Korea, it's a different war, and war is worse. I don't know how explicit I'm allowed to be. It's bad no matter.
Say anything you want.
Okay, it sucks no matter what war it is. And it definitely tears at your humanity. But we're very lucky in this stage, in this era, that our wars are different. We've lost 7,000 soldiers, I think, to date. And that's a horrible number. But, if you go by World War II standards or Korea, that could have been a month.
True.
We're talking over
but
a decade.
Still, but the experience of being in it is common.
Yeah.
I mean, we lost more people in Vietnam, clearly, than we have in all this time of Iraq and
Afghanistan. Yeah.
But still, the intensity of the experience, is going to be, it may be different wars, different times. Everything is different. But I think one of the things I got from your book was that feeling of the intensity of the experience. It wasn't all about being shot at, although some of that was there, but also just that kind of always being on guard.
Mm-hmm.
the physicality of the experience, you talked about that. I thought it was really evocative, but I think it's more the emotional, psychological edge. And that's sort of what I was getting at. And of course, we're sort of going off into the bigger military experience when your specific experience is really what drives this book. And that is, of being a female and of being raped and of being not believed.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, the core of your story. And so you have levels, I have all these different levels of experience that then, as you tell the story, are really powerful. But I don't think the reader is fully prepared for what happens to you psychologically, emotionally. It's pretty powerful.
Yeah, I mean, the ending as for like the fourth section of the book, I think I said over again, was always a shock to me at every new iteration of PTSD. So I assume it's shocking for the reader too, because PTSD can come in so many different ways.
Right. Well, and we also have that same, I think it's easy for people to fall into categorization. So PTSD now is a known, remember, for other wars, that term never existed. No one knew.
Yeah, they called it shell shock. The thousand-yard stare, shell right. shock, battle fatigue.
Right.
They understood that it was something was there.
Right, but all of it kind of, by not giving it a real name, I think in a way, made it harder for the people who were experiencing it. And then for a lot of people, there was no support system.
Yeah.
There was no, that is a difference today. There's a
Definitely.
Really much, a better system, even though it's not perfect.
Yeah.
And you also talked about how women in the military did, you didn't explicitly point them out, but almost at every turn, women supported you.
I did have many women support me. And some who didn't, so it wasn't, and some who...
Well, some men who supported you and men
yes,
who didn't.
Yeah. People are, obviously individuals, and it's a complicated situation. I think at one point I talk about the other woman who was raped and how neither of us went out of our way to support each other because we didn't know...
Right.
We didn't know how to deal with it,
Well, you don't know how to deal with it yourself.
Yourself, yeah.
It's really hard to deal with it with someone else.
Especially, and I think people forget too, and I have to look back and remember myself, you're young. Like if I'm 38 now, if I could go back into my body then, things would have played out completely differently.
Right.
And, but then you're young, you're still learning yourself, you're uncertain.
That's true.
There's these people who are in positions of authority and who are older than you, although now that I'm older, I realize they were not that much older. It felt significant, but we're talking about maybe 5 years sometimes. So you're young and dealing with these huge themes, these huge impacts on yourself and with no, at the time, with no one really, no adults to really help me through it.
Well, also, yeah, your parents aren't around. They're not going to help you. It's not like if you were away at college and that happened.
Yeah.
You would have a different experience altogether with the Army.
Weekends,
They're actually your parents, effectively. Mm-hmm. And so they're supposed to take care of things.
Which leads into perfectly the chapter that I talk about, Feel Aside, where, the Army even says, oh, we're supposed to be your father, and we're supposed to protect you. That's how we want the Iraqi men to view you women. And, and that's when I was like, well, if you're being my father, you're not doing a very good job.
Well, but that's partly the problem.
Yeah.
Male figure is going to have difficulties understanding what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's not to excuse it at all. Now, one question is, and I sort of was trying to get at that earlier. So this was 2002 when it happened?
The rape happened in December 2002.
Right. So you're in Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Yeah.
So today, do you think there is a better understanding in the military of what happens when you have these men and women together in environments where some men are not really good at, dealing with women.
Yeah.
You can't just say to a bunch of guys, you're not supposed to do this.
Yeah.
There has to be more.
They definitely have upped the training. It really actually all comes down to the command. So if you have a command who takes the training seriously and who holds everybody in line and says this behavior is not acceptable, you'll find fewer instances of rape in that unit. If you have a command, whether it be the captain or the first sergeant or even the platoon sergeants, who kind of like make a joke out of the briefings and poo-poo it and aren't really seen as taking it seriously, that trickles down to the other people in the units, both the men and the women. So women might feel, or any sexual assault victim, because actually men are military sexual assault victims as well. Any victim is going to be less likely to speak out if they don't see a seriousness in their command. That's one place that the command needs to really work hard to present that they are very serious about this topic. They've changed the way reporting goes, and it's both good and bad. Now you can report it and prosecute it, meaning your unit finds out, everything goes forward the exact same way that I did it, which was the only option at the time. Or you can report it and not prosecute, meaning you report that it happened and it sort of just stays in a file and your command is not notified, nobody's notified, and you can either come back to it later, maybe when you're more adjusted, or it just stays in your file so that you have proof later on if you develop any kind of PTSD or trauma for when you get out and you're seeking help, because they did have a huge problem with, I know women personally, and I'm sure it happens to male sexual assault victims as well, but I know lots of women who were raped, didn't report it, and then later when they're veterans and they're having serious PTSD, they have no proof that this happened.
Well, and you have that experience directly, because if it was not for one doctor who didn't actually treat you, you had a catatonic experience, and I think it was a psychiatrist or a medical.
She was a doctor of some sort.
You said to her, "I was raped."
Yeah.
And she wrote it down. And if it was because your records were lost.
Yep.
Or
yeah.
Whatever, maybe not lost but buried.
Yeah.
Of course, the Army's famous for losing things.
But, that's why they tell us make two of everything.
Right. So you did not have the direct records of what happened to you.
Yeah.
Even though those records were, they clearly were not necessarily believing you or wanting to accept what happened and deal with it. So even if you had your records, there's some ambiguity there.
But at least I would have had more proof.
But you, because you had that one little bit of proof, you were able to then get help from the VA.
Yes. So I at least had some. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what I would have done without that. I probably never would have pursued it at all, because you're so, I have such admiration for some of these women that I know who went forward and pursued help, not having that evidence, and everything that they had to go through. They had to go to psychiatrists who had to evaluate their mental state and their stories, and to have to go through all of that and prove it happened to you.
You went through that too. You absolutely can understand. You went through it contemporaneously. I think that's a big part of your story, is this idea that you had to prove it and also be blamed for it.
Yeah.
So you internalized the blame.
Very much so.
And that becomes, a huge part of your problem going through the rest of your life for a period of time, a long time.
Yeah.
Because recognizing that is is really hard, that you're blaming you're the victim is blaming the victim.
Yes. And the funny part is, even as I was writing the fourth section of the book, that was actually, it was during that process and around that time that I started to realize that I had an epiphany about myself. And the original ending of the book was too dark. I was not in a good place when I wrote it. We actually had to rewrite it. It ends in a better place. But I remember my agent being like, yeah, this is not, this is not a satisfying ending for the reader. But at the time I didn't want to lie. Like I didn't want to give a false ending just for the readers. And, during all that, thinking about it and going through it, I had an epiphany one day where all these fears I had about myself, I realized like, that's not me. That's not who I am. That was not who I am before the rape happened. That's not who I am now. I'm not this, you know, and I'm contaminated, dirty whore, to put it, you know, bluntly, which is what I had felt like for a long time.
That was sort of like an internal dialogue.
That was an internal dialogue. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was not me. And I finally realized it and I was able to, and that's a weird thing to take a decade to figure out.
Maybe what it shows is how trauma can affect people. I mean, you actually don't use that word very often in the book, I noticed. You don't call it a trauma.
Yeah.
And yet it is really it's got to be one of the most traumatic experiences that a woman can have, or I guess men, but it's mostly women.
Yeah.
Who, you know, that is, it's just such a, it is a traumatic experience. And, you know, we internalize trauma. It becomes part of our bodies. You know, there's some research now that shows trauma becomes part of your genetic history.
Yeah, and so does something with your brain, yeah, and all kinds of stuff.
It's really powerful. So it in a way, you should not feel, I mean, it's, who am I to say, don't feel badly that it took so long, because it you know, it can last people a lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I still have things just with the book coming out. I remember the day I got the book deal. We were obviously, that's fantastic news. I got a book deal, had a panic attack, and thought it was the end of the world. Like, I just couldn't handle good news.
Right.
You know.
Felt like you didn't deserve it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're always waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Oh yeah.
All this good stuff happened.
Of course, that's a human. That is a trait that a lot of us share. Anything good that happens, the first thing I think is, well, I better not be too happy about it.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
Who knows what's going to happen?
There was a section that was actually taken out. That was a theme that I had originally intended to go after, and it just sort of didn't fit with everything else. But it was waiting for the bad thing to happen.
Right.
And we were there during the uprising of Sadr City, and we were in Baghdad, and that was when we were moving between units. I mean, between places, because we were in Baghdad initially for the year, and then we went to Al-Qut and Diwaniya.
Right.
Well, when we went to this this holding base for before we went to Al-Qut, they didn't have any space for us. They didn't have any space for the women. So they put us in the morgue, and they just had these bunks lined up in the morgue.
It's in the book.
Oh, is that?
Yeah, yeah, it is. The Al-Qut experience is there.
Well, this is right before Al-Qut. So
oh, okay.
This is, they didn't have any space for us, so they were just holding us in the
place.
Morgue. And then they just, the whole night was just bombing all night long. And there was nothing you could do. So you just sat in those bunks and it was just quiet. And every now and again, you'd see a flash of light. And you were just waiting to see if one of those were going to hit your building and you were going to die. And I remember one girl saying, I can't wait to get out of Baghdad. And I was like, you want there to be anywhere but there, you know? And it didn't matter. We were going to Al-Qut. We just did not.
Right.
So, and that was a theme that I wanted to explore, this just waiting for the bad thing to happen.
Right. Well, but that's part of the military, in a war zone.
Yeah.
Because bad things are happening all the time.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat random. I think that is something that everyone who's in it's not just in war, but there are other similar experiences, but the randomness is really what I think is most, it's often difficult for people.
Yeah.
Because then you survived, but the person standing next to you didn't. And that's hard to accept.
And I think I talk a little bit about that in the sense that during the chapter, What Isn't Mine, is that's supposed to actually talk a little bit about the randomness, or about the way we have no control. And people, especially people who haven't experienced trauma, are very comfortable with this idea that they have some kind of control over their lives, whereas people who have experienced trauma, the randomness of trauma, right, understand we have absolutely none. And that's sort of what breaks your brain a little bit.
Well, and that I actually think about that, having been in a, the only time I've ever been in an accident, a real car accident, it was like a year ago, hit a deer. Mm-hmm. And it's that same sense of vulnerability that goes, it stays with you.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't compare my experience to being in a war, never.
No, but you understand the feeling that vulnerability.
But that exact moment stays with you because you recognize the randomness,
yeah,
of bad things happening.
Yeah.
And that is terrifying on a certain level. It upsets your sense of who you are in the world.
Yeah.
It's not that we have control. We actually know we don't, but we live as if we did.
Yeah.
Because if you lived without control in fear every single moment of every single day, it would be very difficult. Which
PTSD.
You know
from, yeah.
And you write about that.
Yeah.
This is like this sort of relentless
terror.
Yeah. And the form of that is, as you said, different for each person.
Yeah.
But I think your specific circumstance is made even more difficult. You know, you could have PTSD from being in the war, but you have also PTSD from being raped,
yeah,
and from being disbelieved. I think that there's a lot of, you know, so there, you know, some people might have one of those or two of those, but you have all three.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
And I said at one point in the book, and maybe it's true, that, and this, I think people are going to find this to be a weird statement, so I say it tentatively, but I think that my PTSD wouldn't have been as bad had the rape happened and I had been supported by my command. And that's not to say that secondary victimization is worse than rape, but I think it definitely messed me up mentally. It stayed with me longer.
I don't think that's weird at all to say. I think it really sounds very reasonable and logical that if a bad thing happens to you and then you get to be blamed for it and not helped in any way, but in fact have to deal with also the disbelieving as almost like a personal attack. And as you said, you're 21 years old with, you know, not a fully formed ego at that age in a lot of ways, you know, on your own in this big structure. I think that, you know, you have every reason to understand that secondary trauma is really powerful.
Oh, definitely. And I think that stayed with me for a long time. And maybe it also made it harder for me to process the rape at all. Like, for example, and I say this at one point in the book, a lot of my emotions were projected at my commander, my anger, my rage, my wanting for revenge. And I talk very little about any of the emotions projected at the rapist because I couldn't think about him. It was like almost like a blank spot. I couldn't bring myself to think about
him. Right, well,
you
displaced him with the commander.
Yes,
yeah.
Who was easier to be able to
there.
Project my
also,
emotions.
Also, they moved the guy who did it.
Yeah.
They
so I had to work with him for a little while, and then, they moved
he's
him.
He's gone, but your commander was still there.
Yeah.
And he's there as a constant reminder. And in one scene later in the book, and I guess later in the story, you got to confront him.
Yes.
But it was not a satisfactory. I mean, in a way, though, I thought it was really, you were very honest about that, you know, in terms of how what he said was not completely, you can't just write it all off, you know, that his position wasn't justifiable in a lot of ways, but it was difficult for you to find a kind of, like, it's like climbing up the side of a cliff with no handholds.
Yeah.
You couldn't figure out how to address him.
And I always knew that scene was hard to write, and I always know that moment was very stuck with me forever. Obviously, I wrote about it. But when I was doing the audiobook, I was able to, I gave them a heads up before I read through the rape scene, and we actually got through it. I don't know how well it sounds, but we got through it. But when you, if you hear it, the only time I cry in the whole book is that scene. And we had to take a little bit of a break, and I had a really hard time. That was just a, that moment just broke me, on many different levels. When I finally got to
Right.
confront him and
Right, because you didn't get resolution.
And then having that blame put back on yourself all over
Well, a different, but a
again,
different
but a
blame.
different,
It's the blame that says, if I had handled it differently, I could have rescued myself. But what you don't, by doing that, fail to recognize that you were not in a position to rescue yourself, and that you weren't given the support that would enable you to be rescued. And so, yeah, you could argue, we can always argue, that we're responsible. We always, that's a human thing, I guess, that we think. But as the scene is written, as your story is told, it looks to me like there was another, you kind of blamed yourself for blaming yourself, you know?
It's and I think about this now. Have you ever seen like or read about, I mean, I think there's even a Netflix series about it or something, how people had give these false confessions, and
Oh
you're just like,
yeah.
how could anyone ever do that if they weren't guilty? And even I remember thinking this, and I'm what, 38, and I'd be like, oh God, I would never give, I would stand my guns. And then I realized, well, I didn't. Not that I gave a false confession, but he got me to not use the word rape. That was his goal. He pushed and pushed until he got to it.
Right, and when somebody is in a position of weakness, you can manipulate them to get the outcome you want.
They're a position in authority, and
That's
they're
right.
talking to you like they know,
Also, you're afraid. You're pain in pain.
And you're scared of the word.
Right.
Rape is a huge word. It's the act obviously is terrifying, and then being ha telling people about it is terrifying as well. And it makes, and I say this in the book, a lot of people don't like the word because it's so raw and it's explicit, and it, exactly what happened. So it was hard for me to even say the word then, because you're admitting to exactly what happened instead of hiding behind shadows, hiding behind
Right.
sexual assault or sexual harassment or
That's true.
the exact words that I say. I don't know what it was, but I knew it was wrong, which is what the criminal investigation guy got me to say. It's just it was a hard moment, and it's one of those things where you realize when you're older and you look back, you'd be like, well, obviously I would have done it differently, but now I can. It's funny how you can do something when you're younger and you don't realize it,
Yeah.
how you were. So that's the same behavior. That's why I brought up like the making false confessions. That's the same behavior, and you don't even recognize it, even though you did it. And so when I went put two and two together, I was like, oh my God, well, now I understand why this person might have been pressured
Right.
after how many hours of interrogation. Well, I was there. How could I not have recognized that?
That's true. Well, yeah, in a lot of ways you were almost, you could almost say you were tortured. You were given that sort of psychological torture to get to get you to say the things that they wanted you to say.
And they certainly wouldn't have said that. They would have said,
No,
oh,
they
we
don't
were
feel that way
just,
at all. I mean, that's the other, there's always the other perspective is so hard to deal with. When he argues with you, when your captain argues with you, it's pretty clear he has a strong system in his mind to protect himself. And your sergeant, who you liked a lot, who's basically said he forgot everything that happened, which comes off sounding pretty bogus.
He went through some significant trauma around the same time that I actually knew about, but I didn't know until later that, because he had told me about it at the time. I didn't know about it till later that that messed up his memory.
Although maybe it, well, maybe,
Or
okay, so,
maybe it
or
didn't. I
maybe
don't
it, you don't really
know.
know. But it is possible, it is true that people put away things they don't want to deal with, and then they forget them. I mean, we, memory is so complicated. You know, you, I thought about this a lot, you know, when I read someone's memoir, because I remember things that when I was little, I have an experience that I'm pretty sure is not really the experience, but it's the one that I think I remember from pictures or from stories that I was told, you know. And
You
when you get
create,
older, I think you also, if you tell yourself something enough, you actually can believe that you did it.
I absolutely. And there's this one scene that this sort of came into play. The scene where Female King and I are in the guard tower, when the Red Cross, the Red Cross was bombed. When I originally wrote the scene, I thought we were talking about how victims will blame themselves for rape. I thought she knew what I was talking about. Now, I met with her, well, before I had completely finished the book, so it was maybe a year ago or so. And I told her what the book was about, and she never knew. She never knew that happened. And I realized, one, that I was having a conversation that I thought was something entirely different. And also that she doesn't really remember that entire Red Cross thing. I'm like, how could you not remember that? I remember it as clear as day. And she says she doesn't remember a lot of things from Iraq. She just almost
Well,
blocks it
I think that,
out.
yeah, and I actually can attest, although I, again, I'm older than you are, and I'm thinking about things that happened a long time ago, but I'll talk to somebody who I know and they'll say, well, remember when we did this? No, I have no clue. What are you talking
My
about?
husband does that to me all the time. He's like, remember what we did? I'm like, no. He's like, you have a horrible memory. I was like, well, I remember certain things very
Well,
well.
I think a lot of it is situational. It's what's important to you at that moment. Because aside from the people who remember everything with photographic memories, and there are such people, most of us just don't have enough room in our brains for all the experiences. So you have to leave some out. And there, it's, I don't think, I think it's somewhat random. I don't think it's that the most important experience is always going to stay, but it is clearly true that some things are more important to you than they are to that person you were sitting with. So you'll remember it.
But they
For
might
them, it was
not.
just another day, you know?
No, that's so true that you remember things and another
But it'll work the other way around. Something that's really important to them in their lived experience probably was just another day for you. So, but I think that, I mean, this sort of goes to one of the problems of writing a memoir. In a lot of ways, you're better off than a lot of people who try to write the book about their whole lives when they're older. It's better that you're writing this now because your memories are, you're closer to the time of it happening. Your memories are better.
And I had written down a bunch of stuff
So now
several years
you
ago.
mentioned in the book at various points that you had wanted to be a writer, but that was sort of never really fully you know, kind of explored or talked about. It kind of emerges, but do you were you wrote a novel at one point and then just threw it away?
God, I was always a writer. I mean, I was writing since literally second grade. I remember I wrote this short story that we turned into like a bound book, and my second grade teacher loved it, and she said, "Oh, you're going to be a writer." And I always was writing horrible stuff because, you're like
Well,
eight.
kids,
But even, in high school and then before we went to Iraq, I'd written almost a complete novel. And I came home and I remember reading it. And I just threw it away because it was very black and white. There was the bad guys and there was the good guys. And the bad guys are always these mindless, evil creatures that have no humanity. And then we see this in media all the time. You can watch any Star Wars, Marvel movie,
Oh,
anything
yeah.
like that. You always see that, even Tolkien, the evil is always like this non-human element. And then the good guys are, more like us. And it
Well,
angered
Game of
me.
Thrones, the ice people are, they're just, who knows what they are? Everybody else is a human
Although
being.
I think Game of Thrones does it a little better because they show the different sides and they show, I mean, aside from the ice people, which I think was a totally unnecessary element in my opinion. And it frustrated and annoyed me, and I just dumped the whole thing. And so I wrote, or I and I had written another novel that I'm still with fantasy elements because I love that. I love what you get to do with that, the themes you get to explore with that, that you don't always get to do in other types of genres. But that showed the humanity on all sides. And also, I don't really believe evil exists in the sense that I think we use that as a cop-out. Oh, they're evil. They're just evil people. And no, they do something for a reason. And you have to really sit and try to explore that reason. Well, why are they blowing themselves up? Why are they willing to do what we see as evil things? And that's, you know, there's still humanity in that person. It's just, you have
well,
to.
Well, and also evil is in the eye of the beholder in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, I'm sure we were the evil empire to many parts of the world.
Well, and in one of the ways that we create the ability to kill people is by dehumanizing them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So they have to be. I know it's terrible words that people use for the other side in any war.
And that I mentioned this in the book that we use the term Haji as a derogatory term, which compared to a lot of other wars really isn't that bad, but it's still meant to dehumanize. It's still meant to turn them all to turn an entire society of people into a single word.
Or things.
Even saying insurgents, which isn't really demonizing, but when you call an entire people insurgents, you strip them of
their individuality. It gives you the ability to to take away, you're no longer seeing them as people. And the same thing is true when you call someone evil. You've put them in a box that in a lot of cultural and spiritual and religious constructs makes them less than human also.
Yes, exactly. And that was what something war showed me. I think that there's not really a good or a bad. I mean, there's layers, but like a lot of the world is just gray, and you just kind of have to figure out that gray.
Right, but war is not where you have that opportunity most of the time.
I think that's yes and no. I think that's one of the reasons why soldiers come back so messed up, in the sense that you do realize, like, yes, you use these terms.
No, yes, exactly, because in effect you're living the contradiction.
Yeah, you're dehumanizing them, but you also see people, and you realize that they're people. And somebody, when you kill someone, they have a family that suddenly mourns them. They're no longer a construct. That's a person. And so while war should be the time where you get to shut down and just say good, bad, it's really where that shows you the most that is not true.
Right, which is, because the soldier is a human being doing an inhuman thing.
Yeah.
And that's the contradiction that creates the pain. And that is itself a trauma, I think, to a being.
And recognize, I think one of the things I struggled with too, so here I'll put this in two parts. One of the things I struggled with was knowing that the enemy is just a person on the other side of the line. They have their own lives, their own beliefs. But then you also, which I talk about with the rage, that also though leads into struggling with this rage of, you're being either shot at or you're being mortared and you're not being able to fight back, and everything seems faceless, and you just have this built up tension. Like, it's like if somebody could come and slap you every 5 minutes, but you could never see them, and how angry you get at. You're being slapped, but you can't do anything about it. And how when you finally could be given the opportunity, suddenly you see them, you're going to slap the hell out of them.
No, I think that's a really good thing to recognize.
Yeah.
That's a really good description of how that would work.
Yeah. That's the best way to explain that growing rage that then makes soldiers do things that seem unbalanced. So for example, this is not my experience. This is an experience that I could talk about that has happened to another soldier. But they were talking about how when this person ignored the signals to come to the gate, you know, like at a checkpoint. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now they might have a bomb on them or all these different things. So they're ignoring the signals. Now they're a threat. You know, they're not stopping. And instead of being shot once, which is more than enough, they're shot, you know, 20, 30, 40 times. And it's because of an outlet of rage and anger. And
right, the legitimate target now becomes
everyone,
the focus of yeah. all of the accumulated rage.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I think that you can recognize that in yourself too.
Yeah.
You know, like the way you describe it, I could say I understand.
Yeah.
That could work.
And I was lucky. I understand that I was lucky that I never had to shoot my weapon. And for a while, that was almost a point of shame, too, because, you know, you're not the real soldier if you haven't.
Well, but we never really talked about this. You were in military intelligence
yeah.
as an interpreter.
Yeah.
So in a way, you know, you were not expected to be a frontline soldier.
Yeah. I wasn't really. I was on guard duty or convoy. Convoy can be pretty dangerous.
Right.
But
well, you drove a Humvee.
Yeah,
that was your job a lot of the time.
Well, yeah, when we would go out, I would, you know, I was supposed to be the lead driver into Al-Kut, and I don't remember what happened, but we had like this makeshift scout or gunner on the back of our vehicle. It was so hodgepodge? I don't know if that's the word. It was like this stupid pole with a cushion and all like duct taped together. And every time I hit the brakes, the gunner would almost go over the hood. So we thought we were so badass going up and down the line, you know, pulling security, right. But that was all we had. We were MI. We didn't have armored vehicles. We didn't have any right. gunners. He had an M249. God, I don't know how many times I almost killed that poor guy trying to drive.
So do you feel like now talking about the war experience do you find it a little kind of surreal in a way, you know, to kind of re-experience all that stuff that you went through, even though you're here? Like we're talking, you live in Connecticut, we're
yeah.
in New Haven, it's really nice here.
Yeah.
You know, does it, do you feel a kind of, or is it far enough away now? And having written the book, do you feel like it's like a little less powerful?
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, time doesn't heal everything, but it certainly gives you a little distance. And it feels like another life, to be honest. Like sometimes when I talk about it, I'm like, wow, that it feels like it happened an entire lifetime ago. And I guess now the 20 years, you know.
In a way, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, it's still you, but you do get to put it in another place.
And I still color a lot of my experiences with humor, dark humor. That's the way I personally deal with it. And it's gallows humor. A lot of soldiers do that. There's also sometimes, and this is just messed up, a slight satisfaction in telling a joke that is true, that happened, and the slight satisfaction you get from a civilian who's just startled. You just scared them shitless. And you just kind of feel like, yeah.
Well, there's a power.
Yeah, again, it's a little power dynamic right. that you right. probably should not be getting off on.
I remember when the people I knew were coming back from Vietnam, they would tell jokes to each other, and everybody else who hadn't been there, we were completely lost. We had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And they were having a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun for them to share that experience and also know that we had no clue.
Yeah. Right? And sometimes soldiers will, you know, they're sharing their experience and one-upping the brutality in a humorous way that to civilians looks terrifying.
Terrible. No.
Yeah.
Not necessarily good.
But it's more of like a camaraderie thing. Like, oh, right. you get it.
Exactly.
So what I'm telling you right now is funny.
Right.
But when I go to bed at night, I think about it and it's not funny.
Right.
You know?
You need to defuse the tension.
Yeah.
And it's good to do it with other people who have the shared experience. I think that's why, you know, people who have been there tend to, you know, they like to hang out. Not all the time, but it's a good way of...
You feel at home with other veterans. I mean, most women, myself included, marry veterans. My husband was a Marine infantryman. He didn't go over, but I always joke and I think I don't know very many women that I served with who end up marrying a civilian or I mean, I know some who may be on their second marriage or with a civilian, but almost everyone I know that I served with ends up marrying military. And I think there's a reason for that,
that's
you know?
Interesting.
Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
We're turned into a different breed of woman, right. You know? You're kind of a little bit more aggressive or masculine or open
well,
you know.
You have a different experience and you
yeah.
have different skills too and,
yeah.
and knowledge and experience. No, I think that's interesting. Well, so I know this is your first book.
Yes.
And do you, you know, and you don't have to answer this, but have you thought about, like, now you've written this as a really, and you have to go through the experience of it being in public, talking
yeah.
about it, you know, it's going to be published and people are going to, you know, you so thinking about your next book may not be the thing that's
Oh, I'm writing another one, yeah, right now. I'm writing actually, I mean, I normally do, I have on the back burner my urban fantasy, I have that on the back burner right now. I'm writing a military fiction novel, which, you know, hopefully will go somewhere. It's about four women in 2003, 2004, Ramadi, Iraq, who are part of the, several of them were part of the Lioness program, which was this program that took women who were maybe mechanics or supply or cooks sometimes, and they would attach them to infantry units because they learned that having a woman there could either diffuse a situation, like for especially on like traffic control points. If you put a woman there, suddenly
right.
it wasn't so like...
all that testosterone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
I say in the book, like you put a woman there and suddenly
right.
it all changes, you know? And they but they also went on night raids, kicking down doors, were on patrols, were in firefights. There was a huge Ramadi battle in 2004. The Marines actually came in on. The Marines took these army girls, women, with them on these patrols. And it's very little spoken about. There was a documentary about it. But beyond that, nobody knows that it was happening. And a huge part was of that was because women weren't supposed to be in combat roles. So they were attached to the infantry, they weren't a part. So that was how they, it was just a very minor wording that they could get around
right.
Saying these women weren't in the combat roles, they were attached to it, but they were doing everything that the men were doing.
Right.
So I wanted to write about that. And then it spans over into civilian world and how these women deal in different ways with their PTSD and stuff like
right.
that.
Well, so that sounds really good.
Yeah, hopefully.
Well, I really appreciate you talking to me. I think this is an amazing book. And I won't say the trite thing, you know, it's like I loved reading it because it was really painful. It's hard.
I've had a bunch of, you know, people say that to me that I'm like, oh, well, I hope you enjoy it. And they're like, well, I can't say I enjoy
no,
it or I like it. And
right,
I'm like,
it's not a book you would say, you know, did you enjoy reading it? I think it's a book that you should say, did you find it compelling? You know,
yeah.
Did it affect
maybe
you?
I need to change my wording.
I thought it was very impactful. It made an impact on me. It made me think and experience. I thought a lot about trauma. I think a lot about PTSD and in some ways, in different ways. So, and a lot about the experience of women in a male environment, which is, I think, really worthwhile understanding.
Yeah.
So, and hopefully will help people be better.
Yeah. So hopefully people will respond to it and find it compelling. I guess I can't say like or enjoy it anymore.
Well, thanks. Thanks for doing this.
Thank
really
you for having me.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Ryan Lee Dosti about Formation, a woman's memoir of stepping out of line.
Thank you.
Thank you.